this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. William Sook. He is the director of the Superfund Basic Research Program, and he's going to tell you a little bit about the nanotechnology seminars. Dr. Sook?
Thank you. Larry, can you hear me?
You sound great.
Okay, good. First of all, I want to welcome everybody who is calling in, as well as those who have access to this through various other ways, such as the conference room that we've tried to set up for this purpose. Response to this particular seminar series of risky learning has been incredible. We're going to be having a discussion over the next year on the application and implications of nanotechnology for Superfund. It's obvious that this is an exciting and outstandingly interesting set of domains of research. And I think also that it's being done in a very exciting manner that can, as essentially an outstanding model for reaching as many people as possible in an active way as possible. Risky learning is brought to you by the NIEHS EPA Organizing Committee, consisted of offices here in my office of the Superfund program at NIEHS, as well as ORD at EPA and the regional offices. At EPA, I would especially like to thank a number of people, and not in any particular order, but I'd like to thank Randy Wetzel and Jane Michelle, Bob Walton, Mike Gill, Mitch Lassett, Marty Otto, Warren Lynn, Charles Maurice, Marion Olson, and Nora Savage, who you'll also hear from later, and I'll discuss in a minute. I would like to thank the Clue-In staff, the people who are actually bringing this to you digitally. And my special thanks at NIEHS are to Maureen Avakian and Larry Whitson at MDB, and especially also Heather Henry in my office, who has helped put on this whole, what's going to be has organized a year-long seminar series devoted to nanotechnology. Just as an advertising pitch, in February 13th, we're going to be looking at arsenic and heavy metal removal, specifically in water treatment, and we'll have from the Pacific Northwest National Lab, Shaz Matigold, and from Rice, Mason Thompson. In March, on March 15th, and then again on April 19th, we're going to be using this method in and focusing on nanotechnology for looking at DNAPL remediation. And part of the reason for two seminars for DNAPL remediation is our response last year to the DNAPL seminar series was also outstanding. And so we wanted to devote an effort to looking at nano tools for DNAPL remediation. At that point, we're going to bring in Matthew Hall from Luna Innovation, which is an EPA SBIR grantee, who is an EPA SBIR grantee. Greg Lowry from Carnegie Mellon, an EPA STAR grantee, and this will be followed by Marty Otto from EPA, Mary Logan from EPA Region 5. And these sessions will cover real site experiences in using nanotechnologies, and we'll also discuss costs and community involvement. So I'm sure you want to be tuned in for that one. Later sessions will focus on environmental sensors in May, and we'll take a break over the summer, and in the fall, we're going to be looking at environmental and health implications associated with the use and application, development and use and application of nano tools. Each seminar will be announced in EPA's Tech Direct newsletter, and upcoming links of upcoming seminars will be provided under additional resources, which Larry Whitson will tell you about how to find this at the end of the seminar. You can also tap into the NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program website, and which is also searchable, and you'll be able to find the seminars there. Okay, so that's what we're going to be doing, and that's what we're doing right now. Our speakers today are Drs. Nora Savage and Dr. Nigel Walker. Their bios are available on the seminar homepage. Our first speaker this afternoon is Dr. Nora Savage. She is an environmental engineer at EPA ORD's National Center for Environmental Research. And today she will provide an overview of EPA's internal efforts to develop a nanotechnology research strategy, as well as efforts to be in coordination with the national and international efforts to understand nanotechnology. Dr. Savage?
Thanks, Bill. Okay, again, I am from the Office of Research and Development, the National Center for Environmental Research. And I am told to proceed by telling you what slide I'm working on. So slide one is just the title slide, and if we can proceed to slide two. I have an outline of the talk. First, I'll give a brief overview of nano, what nano is, at least under the NNI definition. The NNI is the National Nanotech Initiative. I will go through the NNI structure and activities, discuss EPA's interest in nano, give some specifics with respect to Superfund, which I know is the audience that is attending today. Talk about ORD activities and some sponsored research and then a path forward for the agency. Proceeding to slide three, the definition of nanotechnology. Some people think that it's just the ability to get more money from an increasingly shrinking federal budget, but that is not the definition of nano. Also, you'll find that more businesses will append nano to their product or to their company as a way to try to get more research funds from agencies, from venture capital, and to get consumers kind of excited about the product. And finally, as many of you know in this field, there are 1,000 nano meetings, and there's probably one every hour of every day of the year, and probably multiple meetings, so that you can never go to every nano meeting that exists. And as more societies, professional societies get involved and more agencies, the number of meetings increases exponentially. Proceeding to slide six. Okay, so I went through four, five, and six. I'm sorry, three, four, and five. Proceeding to slide six. The NNI definition is understanding and control of matter at this length scale, approximately 1 to 100, because we do realize that at times above 100, you do get those unique, novel features, novel properties associated with certain compounds. And so that discussion is ongoing through several of the standards organizations, ANSI, ASTM, etc. It's where you have unique phenomena that enable novel applications, and you can image and measure at this length scale. So it's also the ability to manipulate at this length scale. Even though we've had, say, nanoscale gold that had novel properties, we weren't able to manipulate at that level. We weren't sure what we were doing at that level. And so that's why we put that third piece into the definition. To slide seven. What are some of the unique properties of nanoscale materials? They're varied. They can be chemical reactivity that's different from macroscopic. Again, I'll mention gold because typical gold, of course, you know, is yellow and not very reactive. But when you get down to nanoscale gold, it can be red in color, and it's very reactive. It has a vastly increased surface area per unit mass. Quantum effects at times come into play, so you have unique electronic, photonic, and magnetic properties. And then we also have the new chemical forms of common elements, for instance, carbon nanotubes and fullerenes. And you may be aware of the debate that the MSDS sheets currently list carbon nanotubes as graphite because it's the same chemical material, but it actually is a different material. Proceeding to slide eight. There are basically three types of nanoscale materials. They're the engineered materials that we'll be talking about during this presentation, and those include what I've listed here, fullerenes, nanotubes, that's NT, metal oxides, quantum dots, nanowires and dendrimers. Then there are the incidental or anthropogenic nanomaterials that are particles emitted from combustion processes or other industrial processes, vehicles, and construction activities. And then you have natural, of course, nanoscale materials emitted from plants or trees, from oceans and erosion, etc. Slide 9, I attempted to give a brief overview of some of the products that are currently on the market. You may be aware that the Wilson Center has a nanoproduct database that you can go to and view the different nanoproducts that they have determined are nano, and they've done some weeding out of products that aren't really nano, so I believe that they don't list their nano iPod, but I haven't really gone through that database recently. But some of the nanoproducts include cosmetics, the face creams and sunscreens, textiles like the clothing and furniture that repel stains, withstand odor, sports equipment including tennis balls and rackets, bicycles, baseball bats, electronic equipment, appliances. You may also be familiar with the Samsung washing machine that emits nano silver that OPP, the Office of Pesticide Program, has decided to regulate not as a device but as a under FIFRA as a pesticide. It's not that they're regulating it as nanotechnology. They're just looking at the emission of silver from these washing machines into wastewater streams and what that may do to ecosystems. I don't know if you're going to have a talk on that later from someone in OPP, but they're better able to talk about that. And then there are nano cleaning agents, and you may have also heard about the cleaning agent in Germany, Magic Nano, that was determined to not contain nanomaterials at all, actually engineered nanomaterials, but approximately 100 people were hospitalized when they attempted to use this bathroom cleanser. Apparently they had two formulations, the spray and then the aerosol. The spray didn't cause any issues, and when they aerosolized it to get the product to come out better, it ended up causing edema and some respiratory problems in a lot of people, and those were called from the market. Proceeding to slide 10, I've just put some pictures on so you can see some of the nanoproducts, and I have the nano silver washing machine there from Samsung. The Hummer, which I have there as well, has a nano composite in the bumper. And the dots that you see to the right of that are the materials that are in that bumper. Proceeding to slide 11, the National Nanotechnology Initiative. EPA has been a member of the Nanoscale Science, Engineering, and Technology Subcommittee since 2001. Approximately 25 federal agencies and departments participate in the NNI, and we actually do the coordinating of federal research, both extramural research to academic and not-for-profit institutions and small business innovation contract awards. The Nanotechnology Coordination Office, that should be coordination, is a point of contact in the Secretariat so that when media, for instance, have questions about a nanoproduct on the market or something that they would like one of the federal agencies to address, they contact the NNCO, who then fields the questions to the appropriate federal agency. Proceeding to slide 12, I've just given you a brief, simplified flowchart of the NSAID and some of the subcommittees that reside within the NSAID, and then I've listed the departments below. Looking on to the left at some of the subcommittees, the NEHI, the Nano Health and Environmental Implications Subgroup, is the group that put out the research document that we held a public meeting on January 4th, if some of you attended that. And right now, that group, we are engaged in prioritizing the research, and then we hope to work together as federal agencies to determine which agency is best tasked and funded to handle which research topic area. NILI is the Nano Innovation Liaison with Industry, where we try to work with industrial groups. And when I say industrial groups, it's not like we don't work with Dow or DuPont per se. We work with the American Chemistry Council. We might work with Pharma, with Bio, et cetera. So we work with industry associations. The NPEG is the Nano Public Engagement Group. We held a meeting last May, 30th and 31st, here in D.C., with certain invited public participants, and we plan to hold another meeting this year at some point. We're still working on dates. And then the Global Issues of Nano Gin, that is our international effort within the NNI. Let me take a minute right here to say that the NNI, or the NSET, there's no budget given to it from Congress. Sometimes people think that we're given $1 billion and we apportion it accordingly, give EPA 5, give, you know, FDA doesn't get any. That's not what happens. The agencies come together and they have determined beforehand what piece of their budget they can allocate to nano, and we have determined that we have five. Typically we have five per year, $5 million. And then we get together to discuss coordination of that research. So it's not extra money for the agencies. That's, I want to make that clear. And also, even though the Nanotech R&D Act authorized the money to certain agencies, EPA being one of them, we never got appropriations for that. So I want to make that statement. Proceeding to slide 13, I've just given you an overview of the NEHI subgroup and some of the work that we have determined within different agencies fits within the environmental health and safety aspect of nanotechnology. And you can go through those at your leisure. Slide 14, it is the President's FY07 research budget request. These documents you can also get at the NNI website, which is www.nano.gov. And I have listed under additional resources on that CLUIN webpage, that webpage along with some other ones that you might find helpful in terms of getting different information about nano. So as you can see, EPA, we may get $8 million in FY07, and that's why we're trying to work now to develop a nano research strategy to figure out the best targeted research for us to conduct, working with the other agencies to allow them to conduct other research so that we have the best use of our limited resources. Going to slide 15, there's the NNI website. I've listed it there. And I've listed the goals for the National Nano Initiative, which are to maintain a world-class research and development program aimed at realizing the full potential of nano, to facilitate the transfer of new technologies to products for economic growth, to develop educational resources and a skilled workforce, and to support the responsible development of nanotechnology. Slide 16 just is an example of some of the documents that you may obtain from the NNI website. Going on to slide 17 and get into EPA's interest in nano. The agency is interested in nano from a variety of reasons, including promise for environmental protection. We can clean up the current or past environmental problems and improve our present manufacturing and chemical processes, and then prevent future environmental problems, Superfund sites, basically. Potential, there's another concern of the potential harmful effects to human health and the environment, and as our mission is to protect human health and the environment, then that's another interest area for us. We also have regulatory responsibilities under TSCA, under the Clean Air Act, under the Clean Water Act, and under FIFRA. And finally, consideration of environmental benefits and impacts from the beginning as these technologies develop, and not having another, you know, DDT or CFC issue on our hands, thinking something is great until we see the negative impacts years later. Slide 18 just lists some environmental challenges on the left and environmental opportunities on the right. So challenges are that we're not sure of the toxicity. What are the exposures, the fate, transport, and transformation information for these materials as they go through different environmental media? How do they bioaccumulate, and how bioavailable are they?
Yeah.
What is the critical metric of the nanomaterial in question? Is it particle size or number? Is it morphology?
Yeah.
It's definitely not likely to be mass.
Yeah.
And under opportunities, of course, there's opportunities to remediate, which you'll hear about in one of the upcoming seminars, using nanotechnology to clean some of our Superfund sites, monitoring and detection, being able to develop real-time, accurate, and inexpensive nano sensors, developing environmentally benign processes of P2, which is pollution prevention, novel treatment so that we can develop these treatment processes in industrial facilities and eliminate waste at the source. Multifunctional devices and labs on a chip. You can visit the Arizona State University. Joe Wang, one of our star grantees, does some fantastic work with lab on a chip.
Dr. Savage, let me interrupt you for just a moment. Can I remind the people who are connected on the telephone, you please keep your phone on mute. We're getting a lot of background noise right now. Someone doesn't have their phone on mute. So if you don't have a mute button, please press star 6 on your phone and that will mute your line. When we get to the question and answer period, you can press star 6 again to unmute it. Sorry to interrupt, Dr. Savage.
That's okay. Thanks, Larry. And finally, reduce material energy use and cost, so that using nanomaterial actually results in using less material in the beginning, especially as we get to the atom to atom production. And then we also use less energy, so that will also result in less pollution. Proceeding to slide 19, looking at specifically some Superfund nano opportunities. As I mentioned, the subsurface remediation, in situ remediation, inexpensively using some of the nano zero valent iron that you'll hear about in the upcoming seminar. Groundwater remediation and protection, and real-time monitoring and detection. Proceeding to slide 20, what I've done now is place one of our grantees and some of the research that they're doing behind some of the Superfund opportunities. So Deepika Bhattacharya at the University of Kentucky is looking at nanofilters, and he immobilizes pollutants inside of this membrane structure that is able to dechlorinate a lot these chlorinated toxic compounds. And his research actually has led to several publications. It was completed about, I think, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. Proceeding to slide 21, Mamadou Diallo, who has a joint appointment at Howard University and at Caltech, is looking at using reductive dechlorination of organic pollutants in water using dendrimers, and that's his specialty, and he does usually 20 or higher generation dendrimers that he uses in his research. He received a second research grant from us to look at the implications of some of this research and how these materials transform or move through the environment once they have achieved their mission or their job of dechlorinated or decontaminating sites. Proceeding to slide 22, we have Wilfred Chen at the University of California, Riverside, who's developing a targeted sensor that can detect heavy metals in environmental soil. In air, and he, in water, I'm sorry, and it's a very specific finding that works with his sensor, and it's really cool to hear him talk about it. It's fine-tuned by controlling the temperature and using amino acid sequences. Proceeding to slide 23, we have Joe Wang, whom I mentioned earlier at Arizona State, who does lab on a chip and really flat, he can do flat sensors on semiconductor silicon substrate and also on flexible polymer type substrate so that you can have the sensors targeted to whatever organic or biological compound you're trying to detect. And he was also instrumental in developing one of the handheld insulin monitors that are on the market today. He has one of the prototypes in his office. Proceeding to slide 24, some of the challenges with respect to nano and Superfund include what are the fate of these materials as we put them in the environment to clean these polluted sites, the reactivity of the material, will it react with other things besides the targeted compounds, and then is it going to produce some unwanted reactions or results for us that we have to deal with subsequently. Transport and mobility, how do we get the materials to the contaminated site. That's especially critical for some of the zero valent iron as they find that they tend to cluster right at the injection site and they don't move further. So they, Greg Lowry at Carnegie Mellon, who will speak to you later, will talk about how he's developing coatings to allow them to move further and then the coating degrades and it's able to degrade the compound. What are the effects on organisms and the ecosystem? what are compound interactions. For instance, if we're targeting a chlorinated compound in a subsurface environment and there's some other compound there, will that compound restrict the ability of the nanomaterial to degrade, or will it speed it up and result in some adverse interactions? That's a question that we haven't really addressed yet. What are the biopersistence, bioavailability, and biotransformation issues associated with some of these compounds as we use them? Proceeding to slide 25, looking at some of our nanograntees who are looking at some of these challenge issues, is Chris Theodakaris at Southern Illinois University, who's looking at acute and developmental toxicity for metal oxide nanoparticles. He's looking at both acute, 96-hour, and chronic. Proceeding to slide 26 is Torin Kibbe at the University of Oklahoma, who's looking at developing a type of detector to understand how the materials move and transport through the environment. So he's considering fate and transport issues, and particularly with respect to the vadostone. Proceeding to slide 27, so again, the issues are, as you have this compound that you hope will help us to maybe more quickly, more inexpensively remediate some of the Superfund sites, what are the biogeochemical reactions that occur as we place these compounds in the environment? What happens as the compounds age, as they dissolve, and as they agglomerate or aggregate? Is the sensitivity or the reactivity decreased or increased, or does it cause other interactions with the environment or the ecosystem? And then the effect on target. By target there, I mean not the target compound we're trying to remediate, but I mean an organism that we're looking at an effect on. So that might depend on the age of the organism, the exposure, the dose, the health of that organism, surface characteristics, hazard, composition, and concentration of the material as it interacts with that organism. So these are all questions that the agency is aware of, that NEHI is aware of, and that we are seeking to prioritize how we address these questions within the federal government. Proceeding to slide 28, talk a little bit about extramural research at the agency. To date, we have spent approximately $16 million on applications. By applications, I mean sensors to detect and monitor conventional contaminants in the environment, treatment and remediation processes, as those that I've mentioned, and environmentally benign processes. Implications, we've spent about $17.6 million to date, and that looks at the fate transport transformation, LCA, looking at the full life cycle of the materials, and toxicity. The 17.6 that's mentioned here includes 21 that are about to be awarded, so they actually are not listed on our website currently. We hope that they will be listed by March of this year, that the awards will be actually made. And on 29, it's just a breakdown by area category for the STAR grants. You can see that, and I have the dollar amounts there as well. Scrolling to slide 30, the 2005 solicitation, that's the one that I just mentioned that we are in the process of funding. We opened that solicitation jointly with the NSF, the National Science Foundation, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, NIEHS. It closed February 22nd of 2006, so yes, we are about a year later beyond the closing date, but we are hoping to fund those grants quickly. And again, 21 grants will be funded from that by us, a total of 29, including those funded by the other three agencies. Slide 31, the 2006 solicitation, there's a few changes that have been made in the past few days to this solicitation. We wanted to do an international, this is a solicitation with, NIEHS taking the lead. This is looking at human or toxicity effects of engineered nanomaterials. We are participating to the tune of about $500,000, so one grant really, because each grant is $500,000 for 4 year awards. This solicitation closed recently, January 12th, this week, or last week. And It's with, as I mentioned, NIH just taking the lead, and then NIOSH, I believe, also has $500,000, and EPA is putting in $500,000 to this one. Proceeding to slide 32, we have STAR grantees meetings every year. These meetings are open to the public. You just need to register from our website, which is listed here. Whenever we have a meeting, we post it on our events page, and there's a link for registration. There's no fee for registration either, I should add. These are proceedings from the previous grantees meeting, and we do hope to hold another nano grantees meeting sometime this late summer, early fall of 2007. Slide 33, the path forward. Let me move a little further, so I said I would take 30 minutes. I want to talk a little bit about EPA's research strategy, the stewardship program, and international activities. For the research strategy, slide 34, in fiscal year 2007 and 2008, we plan to focus on the following areas: environmental fate, transport and transformation, exposure, monitoring and detection, that is distinguishing between natural anthropogenic nanoscale materials and engineered nanomaterials, and effects assessment methods consistent with the exposure information that we derive. Slide 35, our request, again, it said 8 in the NNI listing, but we were told 8.6. There's 0.6 that are available for intramural research that they've had historically. And so while it's still $8 million, when you look at our overall dollars, it's 8.6 for both extramural and in-house research. So we'll have about 3.6 for new research in nano at the labs. Well, $3 million for new research, and the 0.6 that I mentioned that's ongoing in one of our labs, research labs. Slide 36. Talked about the nano research strategy. And our specific activities include identifying, adapting, and where necessary, developing methods to measure nanomaterials in the environment, enhancing the understanding of the physical, chemical, and geochemical reactions that they undergo in various environmental media, characterizing persistence and effects of nanomaterials through the full life cycle, providing the capacity to predict significant exposure and pathway scenarios, providing data for use in human health and ecological toxicity studies. For instance, as these materials change and age or undergo transformation in the environment and then they're exposed to either humans or other organisms, they can use the transformed material, the information that we get on how the material is transformed, to do the toxicity studies to really get a better handle on the exposure, the true exposure, not just the occupational exposure, which you will get from the material as it's manufactured from, and you know, straight from the manufacturer. And then providing data for the development of the most relevant testing methods and protocols so that we don't have to test material by material, but we can develop predictive tools to understand how a material based on its structure, function, concentration, morphology will behave toxicity-wise or behave freight and transport-wise in the environment. Slide 37 talks a little bit about our international activities. The European Commission currently has an RFA open looking at environmental health and safety issues for engineered nanomaterials. It closes on May 4th, and it's actually requesting a pre-proposal. What we're trying to do within the office here of research and development is to issue a call that links to that RFA that calls for joint proposals. And their call, they also encourage collaboration with U.S., and so we will encourage collaboration with European researchers, and we hope to have the peer reviews around the same time. Then the National University of Singapore has a national nano initiative that they house within that university, and we're trying to work with them to develop a collaborative RFA. This is more on the applications because that's their area of strength right now. That's the strongest area that they have. And if you look on the bottom there, it just mentions that we're developing an MOU with Europe. The EC is about to be signed. I believe they're going to Brussels next month to sign that MOU. And we're working on one with China as well. Slide 38, we are within the agency. Lots of folks are working to develop an EPA webpage. You know that we have a webpage, a nano webpage that's linked to our INSRA site, which I have listed here. that talks about the extramural research and some other activities within the agency. But what we're hoping for is an agency-wide nano web page that will list Office of Air, Office of Water, pollution prevent, pesticides, et cetera, all of the office links and what their both interests and concerns are with respect to engineered nanomaterials. Slide 39 is just what all of this information I've given you is what we're hoping to have a full puzzle. The solicitations, the collaborations we're working on, the workshops that we hold, and the conferences that we either co-sponsor or that we participate in will give us a full picture of how these materials and behave in the environment, how they may impact exposure, human health, and then how we can best develop nanotechnology to enhance our life, our quality of life. And for slide 40, again, that's just the same thing. We want to make sure that we have a vibrant spring. We don't want another silent spring. And again, if you go to the website, I have listed additional resources, including the EPA Nanotech White Paper, the National Nanotech Initiative website, the NEHI Research Needs Document, and the NNI basic webpage, and then the President's FY07 budget supplement. Some of the different documents that I noted in my presentation, I've actually provided specific links to that PDF so that you don't have to go through the links within the NNI if you'd like to get those. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. We've got a few minutes for questions and answers. Those of you who are connected on the telephone, if you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization and then ask your question for Dr. Savage. Okay, while we're waiting for the phone participants to get their thoughts together for questions, I have one that's submitted by one of today's internet participants. It's from Nancy Stalkwa, Oregon DEQ in Salem, Oregon. Do we know that the current uses of nanoparticles in nanoproducts are safe for human health and the environment? Is EPA studying this? And are we concerned that these particles can be released in our environment? That is, cleaning products in our stormwater or water treatment plant system, and will they eventually reach our surface waters? There's an awful lot in that question.
Yeah.
If you'd like to take a stab at it.
Sure. Those are the questions that we attempted to address in the NEHI Research Needs Document, and I can tell you that in particular, the EPA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, and what's the other regulatory agency? Drawing a blank now. Are specifically interested in those questions. That's why we get together through the NEHI subgroup to address these questions, to see where each of the agencies is sponsoring research. And right now that's basically EPA, because CPSC doesn't really have a lot of money for research. FDA does participate in research through the NTP, and I'm not sure if Nigel will talk about that a little bit. Perhaps he will. And NSF, although they're not a regulatory agency, because they have a large budget and they're very interested in these issues, is also sponsoring a lot of research in this area. For instance, the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology, the Rice University Center, with Vicki Colvin, where Rick Smalley was before he passed away, is an NSF-sponsored center. So, you know, we have some preliminary data that shows some of these particles are not harmful. Some of them may be harmful, but the jury's still out on that, and we are gearing up to make sure that we have all of the critical questions at least identified, one, and then two, that we have research sponsored to address them.
Thank you. We can check back with our phone participants. If anyone has a question for Dr. Savage.
I have a question for Dr. Savage.
Go right ahead.
My name is Virgil Kasunran. I'm with Booz Allen Hamilton, San Antonio, Texas. Dr. Savage, my question is, currently with the Office of Pesticides, if you come up with new pesticides or a new pesticide, you'd be required to perform some kind of a fate and transport study. Is there any requirement now for nanoparticles or nanoproducts manufacturers to do the same?
Only, as I mentioned, for the Samsung washing machine, because they are releasing silver, which is a pesticide, and it's harmful to microbial communities, into the water to... The release of the silver apparently results in you using less energy because you have to use hot water, and it cleans better in cold water. And then, but if these materials are released into the environment, what happens? Because it is a pesticide. So that is the only one I'm aware of, but that's really a question for OPP, and I don't know if we're going to have someone speak from that office in the upcoming months. There is a conference in on nano and agriculture that the OPP representative will be speaking at, and he will be talking about those issues. I can pass that information along to Larry, and he can put that on the additional resource webpage. I don't have it at the top of my head.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And, yes, I can add that to the additional resources.
Thanks.
Check with our phone participant. If anyone has a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization and ask your question.
Yes, I have a question. This is Ricky Sinha from O'Brien and Gear in Philadelphia. Dr. Savage, you mentioned some of the uses of nano iron for groundwater remediation. Does the EPA currently regulate the use of nano iron?
Regulate them as?
In terms of, you know, you mentioned some of the concerns about the role of nanoparticles in microbial communities. So if you were to use nano iron for cleanup of groundwater, is there a concern on the part of the EPA that it would have some side effects of harming those communities down in the groundwater?
Right, that's what we're looking at now. It doesn't look like that's the case, but if that were to be the case, if it were to prove to be a pesticide or have pesticidal properties, then it would come under FIFRA and it would be regulated under OPP. Right now, that doesn't appear to be the case, but again, we're just beginning those studies. The only other, if it were to be regulated under, say, if it degraded the quality of water, it could be regulated under the Clean Water Act. That hasn't been shown to be an issue either, so it's got to come under one of our regulatory statutes and, in effect, something under the regulatory statute, and then that statute would kick in. There's a really good series of publications by the American Law Association, I believe, that looks at all of the statutes that EPA has and how nanotechnology may be impacted by those statutes, and they do the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, TSCA. I have those also. I can send those to Larry. I have each one separately and as a PDF document if anyone is interested. They're a very good compilation of the laws that are applicable for specific engineered nanomaterials and whether or not they might be sufficient. And their view is that they are sufficient to deal with the nanomaterials. And as you know, OPPT, the office that deals with TSCA, is considering the voluntary stewardship program that is looking at, and I didn't include that in here because right now it's being held up for bureaucratic reasons, I guess. Not bureaucratic. It's being held up by, for reasons. So what they're looking at is soliciting information from companies on toxicity of their engineered nanomaterials. And so that will give us a broad starting base to look at.
Thank you. We'll stay with the phone participants. If anyone else has a question, go ahead and introduce yourself and name your organization, please, and ask a question. I have one from an Internet participant here I'll read. Is there any, this is from Andrea Kandara, New York State Department of Health in Troy, New York. Is there any effort by EPA to characterize the differences and similarities in toxicity and other characteristics between engineered nanoparticles and incidental nanoparticles?
Yes, that's a really good question. That's what we're looking at now because we have huge literature and huge research source and looking at particulate matter especially, and ultrafines. And Gunter Oberdorster, who's at in New York,
University of Rochester.
Yes, University of Rochester, thanks. Too many names, too many universities. Is one of our grantees as well, and he is really involved in looking at the differences and similarities between ultrafines and engineered nanomaterials. One of the issues with nanomaterials, some of them anyway, is that they agglomerate once they get into airborne, and so they're not nanoscale anymore. They're actually micrometer-sized agglomerates. And then whether or not this is a loose agglomerate that can be broken apart easily or once it hits your lungs, say, or whether it's tightly bound are some of the research questions that STAR researchers and others are looking at.
Hi, this is Andrea Kandara again. Is there going to be any report or any analysis available of these type of efforts?
All of the grantees, the STAR grantees, do annual reports. Whether Gunter's going to come up with something like that or someone else, there is a paper by Andre Nell at California. I forget which institution, but he's in California. That does look at some of these issues, comparing ultrafines in particulate matter to engineered nanomaterials. There was also a compilation done by Air and Waste Management Association. They had a special issue on nanoparticles by Kim and Biswas Patim. That's available. I have that too. I have those. There's lots of information. It's just how do we assimilate the information to understand where we move, how we move forward, and that's what we're in the process of doing. The agency reps, we do an awful lot of reading, and there are several compilation reports that we read or that we participate in, and now we're at the point of, okay, we know these are the critical research needs, how the agency is going to address them and which agencies will address them. So those two documents I can specifically point you to.
Thank you.
In reference to your question, sure.
Thanks. We can stay with the phone line. Anyone else have a question? Please introduce yourself and name your organization and ask your question. Okay, I have one from an internet participant. This is from Mong Tun with B2G in Calgary, Canada. Mung is wondering if there are any life cycle value assessments in manufacturing nanomaterials.
If anyone has done life cycle value assessments, is that the question?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Because of the limited data on some of the manufacturing processes and because also a lot of these engineered materials are just beginning to enter the manufacturing stage, there are limited LCA studies. There's a professor at Michigan, can't think of his name, who came from Sweden, who's just now beginning to look at this issue. When I think of his name, I'll pass it along. We have three grantees that are looking at this full LCA of nanomaterials. We had Lester Lave and Shannon Lloyd, who completed their nanotech LCA work, and what was that? I guess it was 2005, maybe, they completed, along with Earl Beaver. We also had, we have right now Bhavik Bakshi at Ohio State, who's looking at the impact of nanomanufacturing by way of thermodynamic and life cycle analysis. And Lester Lave was looking at the metal nanomaterials. So we do have some final reports on our web. The final reports, let me mention, on our web are actually executive summary reports. So there is a fuller report. We make those available to EPA staff if they request them. But for folks outside of the agency, you'd probably have to contact the PI to get that full report. But the full report is much more detailed and contains information on what the results were of each of the research studies that they've undergone. And so for Lester Lave and Earl Beaver, those studies have been completed, and those final reports are out. For Bhavik Bakshi, his research began in 2005 last year, so the year before last. So he's just beginning. And then we had another one that we funded. I can't mention the name, but he'll be funded this year, and then there's one that NSF funded under the Correct. The solicitation that closed last February. So, like,
thank you.
Sorry,
I have another question from an internet participant. This is from Eileen Kachaturian with DTSC in Cypress, California. Is there a projected timeline that the EPA will produce enforcement guidelines and restrictions on nanoparticles used in consumer products? And are there any restrictions currently in place?
I wasn't aware the agency produced restrictions on products.
Right.
So
yes, on nanoparticles used in consumer products.
Right. I'm not sure that we do that. CPSC issues recalls and looks at product stewardship. We have a limited role in that. And the question is asking for a timeline, a date for that?
Yes. Is there a projected timeline to produce enforcement guidelines and restrictions on nanoparticles in consumer products?
Under TSCA, we could restrict the commerce of materials that we find are toxic. Again, TSCA is administered by the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, and they are looking at right now that stewardship program coming into play to give them additional data, because as I mentioned, there's just not enough data out there to make calls like that. There's not even enough data for the recall of materials, although there is a suit currently by that's posed to the FDA for some of these sunscreens and cosmetics that contain nanomaterials, that they should require additional tests for those or pull those off the market. I just can't stress enough, the data just isn't there right now. That's why we're struggling as agencies and as an industry as well to get that data so that we can have a complete picture, understand what's going on, and then take appropriate action.
Thank you. We've got a couple more minutes for a couple more questions. Let me check with the phone participants. If anyone has a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization.
Yes, we have a question from Region 5. This is EPA and Lowski. You mentioned that about $30 million is spent on application as well as implications. I was wondering, do we have any specific toxicity values like LD50s or LC50s for any of the nanoparticles?
No. The research that I note is research that's ongoing at a more basic level, trying to understand whether or not these materials are toxic, what type of effects they cause in organisms, and then extrapolating that to humans. I would say that if you discuss with I know that Kevin Dreyer at the InHer lab is looking at trying to get to that point, but we're not there.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We check with the phone participants one more time for a last question, and we'll get ready to move on to today's second speaker, Dr. Walker. Okay, let me turn it back over to Dr. William Sook, the director of the Superfund Basic Research Program, to introduce today's second speaker. Dr. Sook?
Yeah. Thank you, Larry. I want to introduce, as I mentioned before, both Dr. Savage and Dr. Walker's bios can be found on the seminar homepage. Dr. Walker is staff toxicologist at the NIEHS National Toxicology Program. Today, Nigel is going to talk to us about NTP's Nanotechnology Safety Initiative, as well as other current research findings. Nigel?
Thanks, Bill. I just want to thank the Superfund program here for inviting me to give this webinar. It's always nice to push back the technology, especially with trying to get at this whole topic to as broad a number of people as possible. And I think the organizers said there's going to be almost 500 people potentially on the phone here, so welcome to everybody. And there should be some overlap between our talk between me and Nora just because of some of the introductory remarks. So I'll try and breeze through those. Starting on slide 41, if we go to 42, as Nora pointed out, there are, you know, desirable applications of nanotechnology, not only in the environmental aspects, but also for consumer products, and also in the medical, biomedical community, the development of smart therapeutics. As you can see in the upper left panel, this is a dendrimer that is targeted to cancer cells for delivery of drugs. You can use them for imaging agents, and really a lot of aspects that we can tap the nanotechnology unique features for these materials. And as I've mentioned before, quite a lot of nano-enabled consumer products that have embedded nanoparticles within the formulations or in the product themselves. Slide 43. You know, the breadth of these applications really cuts across a variety of different sectors. And it's kind of useful to kind of show the difference, because many people are often concerned about the first group, and that is the actual base nanomaterials, or what I prefer to call nanostructure materials. These are the raw material that would be used in either an occupational setting or could be potentially in an environmental media. The second levels are the intermediate products that are used as raw materials to then make further consumer products. And then you've got, as someone mentioned on the phone, what about the actual product themselves? And then finally, the nanotools that are used at all these different levels. So when we think of how nanomaterials are used and what we mean by nanoparticles, we have to think of the context within which we are thinking about them, be it the raw material as an intermediate or as a product, because how we evaluate the potential hazard and risk from those will be very different, because it's going to determine the type of exposure to an individual. Slide 44. I think Nora mentioned this already. What is nanotechnology? Well, there's certain definitions. 1 to 100 nanometers, that's generally what people consider. And secondly, the properties of that material as you get down to the nanoscale are very distinct from that of the bulk or microscopic level. And this is actually now the ASTM definition for nano. A lot of people have got together to try and figure out what is nanotechnology for the purposes of communication to people. Slide 45. So it was evident from hearing some of the questions that often people consider nanomaterials as almost a single entity. And the one thing I often try to get across to people is nanomaterials are a very, very diverse class of materials. To consider them as a single unit doesn't really do justice to the level of technology and the structural diversity of these. And these are some of the generic pictures of different kinds of materials, be it the single-walled and multi-walled nanotubes, cage fullerenes, nanoshells, metal oxides, dendrimers, core shell, quantum dots, or nanotubes. They're all very different, and more importantly, that really you can't tell from this picture, is the ability to manipulate the surface of the material and the aspects of the material are really what distinguishes nanotechnology from other technologies. The ability to decorate the tubes and these materials with other functional groups, to change the shape, to manipulate these. The whole idea here is that you can actually manipulate at the nano level to induce new properties that you can then manipulate and transfer to the final product or whatever application you're using. So it's very important that we don't consider nanomaterials as a single unit, because the assessment of hazard is going to be very different across them. And even though I'm showing here structural classes, that may not necessarily be the right classification, because the different surface chemistry and the ability to manipulate is very important. And of course, anytime you can manipulate, it gives you power. And as good old Uncle Ben in Spider-Man said, with great power comes great responsibility. So the issue here is that if you do have the ability to manipulate, then you also have the responsibility to make sure that what you are making is not going to be potentially hazardous. And this is an interesting analogy in that As you can see, there's old Spider-Man crawling up the side of the building. Spiders are able to do that by virtue of nanoscale fibers that are actually on their feet. So that's an interesting observation of nature's use of nanotechnology as well. And as people have mentioned, you know, the concern here is, you know, the life cycle of materials as they go through to consumer products that they can get out there in the environment. The examples of lead and GMOs and PCBs, we're very, you know, very familiar with that, and this is especially relevant to the Superfund Basic Research Program, in that, you know, unless we consider the whole life cycle of these materials, then potentially we could be causing more problems than are being created. So slide 48 really shows exactly what we mean by this. We want to make sure that we can head off, you know, any potential disaster before we can see it coming. We don't want to be there staring it down in the face and then trying to figure out what exactly the research is that we should do. Slide 49, and this has been addressed by Nora, that there are a lot of challenges to understanding nanotechnology, and they cut across whatever field you're looking at, be it environmental, occupational, biomedical, that we really want to know the fundamental interactions of these materials in biological systems, both the physical, the chemical, or other interactions. Some of these materials have electrical conductivity properties, and that may induce different interactions that we can anticipate. More importantly, how are these interactions determined by those physical and chemical properties? Because as I pointed out, because of the diversity, we need to understand at that physical chemical level what is causing that. Because simply, if you were to take a given nanomaterial and change the physical or chemical properties, you may be changing its hazard profile. And so essentially, because you could potentially change that, we need to understand how to manipulate that and how to understand that to see what derives it from being biocompatible to what potentially could cause it to be toxic. Because simply knowing it's a nanomaterial doesn't really tell as much. Similarly, knowing that something's a fullerene or a dendrimer or a nanotube really doesn't tell as much at this point, because we haven't defined what it is in terms of the physical chemical properties that actually relate to any biological effect that occurs. The point here, if we can manipulate, we can engineer new applications, and we can avoid those nanomaterials that have the undesirable health effect. And more importantly, for the likes of EPA and the regulatory agencies, you can actually evaluate what the extent might be of the exposures on human health. Moving on to slide 50, so what are some of the technical and scientific challenges? Well, first of all, what constitutes nano? We've heard this in terms of, you know, does it have to be manufactured, or do the natural anthropogenic nanos fall under nano? What are those determinants? How are they different? And the question I hear a lot is, well, does that mean that we have to have a new paradigm for evaluating the safety of these? Are traditional toxicology models appropriate? How do we actually measure nanoparticles in the environment or within cells and tissues? Basically, you know, the last 30, 40 years of chemical toxicology, does that necessarily apply to nano, and what makes nano different from that? Well, we try to address some of that by convening experts, and there's been a variety of workshops that get the brightest minds around this on slide 51. And as you can see, people are really thinking about this quite a bit. Moving on to 52, and the outcome of those has been that there have been a variety of reports that have attempted to bring together the thinking in terms of what are the best ways to move forward in doing experimental work on nanomaterials. The National Toxicology Program held a workshop, seems like a lifetime ago now, but it was actually only 2 years ago, where people first came together to think about this. A report came out of that, and then later, following year, ILCRSI also came out with a similar report, published in Particle Fiber and Toxicology. And essentially, these first two works had very similar kind of findings. And that is that, you know, currently how we do toxicology is probably appropriate for detecting the adverse health effects, no matter what the mechanism is of action. You know, pathology is pathology, and, you know, a disease is a disease. there's not going to be a new manifestation of some new pathology, but maybe there might be. But the point is, at this point, the general consensus is that we think that normal models will be appropriate, but how you actually conduct those is much more important now. So we need to use both in vivo models as well as in vitro to try and link some of the mechanistic findings on the physical chemical aspects to the toxicology that is seen in vivo and in mammalian models. And really to stress that validation of the in vitro effects. Secondly, and this is something that we really need to stress, and that is we are in a new ball game in terms of how to measure the characterization of our material. You know, for chemicals, because this was very much, you regulations are very much based on a mass. Purity is often based on a mass purity. It's very easy to measure the mass of a material, the molecular weight of a material. The thing with nanomaterials is that we've now added the physical and the physical chemical dimension to that. And how you do that is a lot more tricky. The methodologies aren't in place. They aren't effective always in an in vivo situation or in wet environments. But you need to know that so that you can actually develop the right dose metrics. And I'll get to that in a minute, why that's important. Because ultimately, knowing and comparing risks all comes down to comparing the doses at which you get some kind of hazard. And if you don't know the dose of a material that you are using in a study, then you can't effectively compare. Moving on to slide 53, what I mean by that, and this is it gets to one of the questions that was asked earlier, I think it was one of the very first questions, is, are they safe? Are nanomaterials safe? Well, moving on from the issue that different materials, not all nanomaterials are the same, you have to ask, what is safety? Safety we can never prove safety, we can only evaluate risk, really from an environmental point of view. And risk assessment encompasses both, the amount of exposure for an individual, as well as what the innate hazard is, and the dose response over that exposure range. And if you look at these pictures, what this shows you is that innately you've got a shark, and the shark is innately hazardous, but depending on the magnitude of the hazard, and depending on what the exposure is, your actual risk of actually being eaten up is actually vastly different. And it's essentially the same as for any nanomaterial. We need to understand the potency of the hazard as well as the exposure. And that is how we can determine whether we can minimize that risk. Without both exposure and hazard, you can't really assess risk solely. Moving on to 54. So the areas of emphasis for the NIHS and the National Toxicology Program really follow this paradigm shown at the bottom, all the way from the sources all the way to the adverse effect. And that is, you really need to know both the exposure, which is the left-hand part of the paradigm, and how that links up with the biological effects, which is the right-hand half of the paradigm. So firstly, how do we actually measure exposure? And that gets back to our characterization question. Secondly, what properties determine where these things go in the body? Because if we want to understand how an experimental model may relate to a human, then we need to understand how the pharmacokinetics occur in biological systems for nanomaterials. Thirdly, what physical properties determine those early biological effects in the structure function? And then ultimately, how do those relate to the adverse effects? Moving on to 55, sorry. So, getting back to how, given the fact that all nanomaterials are not the same, how do you actually go about prioritizing the kind of research that one might do, and how would you classify to draw out of this information that can cut across different classes, or cut across all materials? So we have to consider within that kind of strategy the fact that you'll have different sizes of materials, you'll have different shapes of materials. The surface can be charged, it can be neutral. The composition can vary from being a very homogeneous material to a highly structured composition. And the structure can be, as Nora pointed out, can be aggregated, it can be myodispersed. So when we think of, our current paradigms. We often think about structure as a paradigm. You know, the size of a nanotube versus a metal oxide versus a dendrimer. But it may work out that the surface may actually be the better classifier. And so the research really needs to try and build this this paradigm of what are the effects across these classifiers and how do they relate to the adverse health effects. Moving on to 56. So this really begets the need to have good physicochemical characterization. So for bulk materials and wet vehicles, you really need two different types of analyses, because in the bulk state you really need all the good identity and the purity and to identify your byproducts, stability, particularly surface area and the crystal forms. But then once you move into a wet vehicle, which is often the form that is used for a lot of animal studies other than inhalation studies, then you really need to be getting into questions of homogeneity of the crystals. Are they stable? Do you get aggregation within that vehicle? What's the size distribution of those aggregated particles if there is aggregation and they're not monodispersed? How does the vehicle impact on the surface chemistry and surface charge? So I think it's fair to say that this is really one of the areas that, and we see it in the research needs documents, that there's a lot of focus on how to measure and characterize the particular nanomaterials so that we can then do effective linkage to health effects later on. Moving to 57. And this is some of the characterization that we currently do on, just to give you an example of, this is an example of metal oxides, the titanium dioxide, just to give you a smattering of the type of characterization that we do on our studies, where we look at both the bulk powders, we look at TEM, we look at the crystal state, we look at the size distributions, and really it's very important to know this even before you engage in a study. Moving on to 58, and this really shows the reason why, because the diversity of sizes and shapes, this shows you that the large circle, the grade circle is actually a 1 micron particle, so you can get aggregates that are that size. But then you look at individual nanomaterials, and they go anywhere from, small 1 nanometer size, C60 monodispersed molecule that you would find in a certain vehicle, to nanotubes, to aggregated tubes, to aggregated TiO2. The fact that you have to know what it is you're testing. Each one of these will appear very differently to the cell and to an animal, and you have to know what it is that you're actually looking at when it gets into the biological system. Moving on to 59, the reason why we know this is from early work from several researchers. This is a prediction based out at the, there's a model on how aerosols deposit within the lung, that we know different sizes will deposit in different areas. That's highlighted by the different colors on the in the schematic on the left there, that if you know the size, you can kind of give some predictions on whereabouts the deposition may be higher, and therefore some of the areas where you may get specific toxicities occurring. Moving on to slide number 60, this also shows that even for a given nanomaterial, depending on how you make it, you may have very different shape and surface properties, and those then actually translate into different quantum properties for the material. More so, that then translates into different biological properties. In slide 61, what we show here, and this is from a review by Gunter Overdorster, is that on the upper left panel A, this is looking at essentially an inflammatory response in the lung to two different size titanium dioxide particles, showing clearly different dose responses when you look at the potency from a mass-based point of view. So this is the mass of material in the lung, and you can see that the nanoscale material is far more toxic on a mass unit. But if you move to the right-hand side of the diagram, to panels B and D, if you actually express the two different studies, based on the surface area of material that's in the lung, you can actually see that they have very similar dose response. And it really is only the difference in surface area by virtue of being smaller that actually shows that you can get more of an effect at lower doses. Because for the same equivalent mass, you have a much higher surface area for a nanomaterial than you do for a similarly composition micron-sized material. The question is, at this point, this has only been done for very few materials, in particular titanium dioxide, and we have no idea whether this applies to other types of nanomaterials. Moving on to slide 62. So we know that surface area has a big impact. What about surface chemistry? And this shows you the diversity in types of surface functionalization one can have on a nanomaterial. And the example I use here is fullerenes. Really, while these are all fullerenes, they all have very different biological properties, and that really comes from the fact that they have different surface chemistries. Moving on to slide 63, this is a study from Vicky Colvin's lab showing that if you change the surface characteristics, you can actually modify the cytotoxicity in vitro to the different materials, going from the upper panel is just naked C60, going all the way down to the bottom panel, which is hydroxylated C60, showing that the addition of hydroxyls, which is in the right panel, you can actually reduce the toxicity in vitro. So we know that surface charge, we know that surface chemistry, and also surface area can have an impact on what the potential innate hazard may be of a material. Moving on to 64. So at the National Toxicology Program, we've been engaged in a variety of studies involving nano. And I just wanted to point out what the National Toxicology Program is for some people that may not be aware of it. We are not actually a regulatory agency. We purely do research for research sake. We have no regulations for it to feed into, but the data is used by regulatory agencies such as EPA and FDA and NIOSH and OSHA to actually support regulations. We are actually headquartered at NIHS, so I am an NIHS NIH employee, but work for the National Toxicology Program. That is actually a multi-department, a multi-divisional entity that incorporates labs at both NIOSH as well as the NCTR, which are part of the Centers for Disease Control and the FDA, respectively. Moving on to 65. So we initiated about 3 years ago a nanotechnology safety initiative, and really the scientific focus for this was to examine how materials enter and travel through the body and what aspects of the physical chemical aspects really do govern nanomaterial safety. If you wish to get more information about ongoing activities, some of the background material and resources, the website is up there in the upper right-hand corner. Even if you go to the NTP website, there's a link onto the Nanotechnology Safety Initiative on the main page. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on our current activities, more just to give you an idea of the breadth of our activities. We're looking at a variety of different kinds of nanoscale materials, basically because, as I pointed out, you can't use a single nanomaterial as a model for all nanomaterials. So we initially used a categorization to look at different, essentially, structural classes. Quantum dots are the semiconductors, and we're looking at pharmacokinetic studies on those and how surface chemistry is controlling pharmacokinetics. We're looking at a variety of different titanium dioxide crystals for both their pharmacokinetics from the dermal route of exposure. This gets at the concerns regarding uptake of titanium dioxide from the metal oxides present in sunscreens. And similarly, we're engaged in photocarcinogenicity studies because certain crystals of titanium dioxide, particularly anatase, TiO2, can actually form reactive oxygen species, and we want to see whether that can actually enhance the UV impact on the skin. And there we're looking at effects of coatings, since metal oxides invariably are not always often have coatings around them. For the carbon-based fullerenes, we're looking at we are engaged currently in pulmonary and oral toxicity studies, and there we're looking at the issue of the size of the materials versus surface chemistry, looking at two different sizes. Dendrimers, which are these essentially branched polymers that are used for drug delivery, we're looking at pharmacokinetics and biocompatibility through a memo of understanding with the National Cancer Institute, the Nanotechnology Characterization Lab there. And we're planning to look at both the size and surface chemistry issue. And single-walled nanotubes are currently being looked at by NIOSH, which is one of our partners. Moving on to slide 66. I just want to give you an idea of some of the other things going on at NIHS. Nora touched on these. The scientific focus here really is on the fundamentals to understand at the cellular and molecular level the biological response. Nora already mentioned one of the RFAs with the EPA on the health effects of nanomaterials, and also the new RFA that just recently came out. And the contact person there for those is Sally Tinkle, and her email address is at the bottom there, because this will be an ongoing series of RFAs over the next few years. In addition, there are also RFAs and grants on enabling technologies, and I think Nora already mentioned this, on developing sensors and remediation devices. And the primary contact there would be David Balshaw, and his number is, his contact information is on that slide. And I encourage you to contact both of those people if you have specific questions about the extramural research, since that is very separate from the National Toxicology Program, which is much more intramural. We do all our work through contracts, but we don't do them through grants. So NTP don't do grants. I just want to make sure people get that one. Moving on to 68. One of our future directions on this, I mean, there really is many ways to go, and if you don't know where you're going, then you might end up in the wrong place. So moving to 69, it's, you know, the way forward really has some impediments, and we really need to get over these to really make good progress and get to a point where we can make some firm decisions and guidances on nanomaterials. Specifically, the exposure question really hangs heavy over this field. We can use certain surrogates for exposure, such as market share and production volume. But in general, you know, we really don't know what exposures are going to be the highest for folks. You know, a lot of the metal oxides have the highest exposure, have the highest market share and production. But ultimately, we don't know if that will be the highest exposure directly to humans. And so that really makes it difficult to prioritize which material you might want to focus on studying, be it at a government testing kind of point of view, or even from an individual researcher's point of view. Often a lot of the information on different materials developed by industry is not always available, so, you know, while safety testing may have been conducted, you're not always privy to that information because it's still proprietary, as they're trying to protect confidential business information and, you know, intellectual property. And so there's a real need to kind of develop creative ways of communicating safety without compromising them. From a researcher's point of view, you know, given that characterization is important, well, where do I get the characterization? Where do I get these materials? Because you can purchase nanomaterials from many different places nowadays. You know, out of the Sigma and the Aldrich catalogs or online at a multitude of different companies that will sell materials. But they don't give you a good characterization. They don't tell you what your material really is. There's certain guidance on the specifications, but don't give you what your materials, or if you put that into a vehicle, what the characterization is in that vehicle. And so that can really limit the interpretation of a lot of the current published data, since the quality of the characterizations up until now has been very poor in publications. Very few of them do good characterization. One of the bigger impediments is how do you actually use in vitro approaches to assess the potential hazard? Because we can't do full-blown animal studies for every material or every permutation of surface size and shape. And so we need to use in vitro approaches, and we need to validate them in order to make sure that the regulatory folks can actually use that information and actually think creatively on how a regulatory agency may actually use in vitro data in assessing risk. As Richard reiterated again, the characterization of materials is more difficult than anticipated. Often the infrastructure for doing that is very distributed. It's not always in one tox department, so you have to develop multidisciplinary teams. The analysis of materials and wet systems is, I can assure you, far from routine. And it really is an opportunity here for people doing the research. They really have to get together with people from different disciplines to really kind of crack this problem. And I do believe that's the end of my talk, and I thank you for your attention, and I'll pass it back and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Walker. I'd like to also thank Dr. Savage for today's presentation. It was a great introduction and overview to some of the relevant nanotechnology issues. We'll start the question and answer period for Dr. Walker in just a moment, and I would like to point out that we'll also try and save some time at the end for additional questions for Dr. Savage as well. Let me just mention, Dr. Savage in the first presentation today mentioned several additional resources. Some of those have already been posted under the link for additional resources on our webpage. The ones that are not there yet, she's going to supply to me, and I will add those to that group. So everything that was mentioned during her talk will be linked on under additional resources. Also on the seminar homepage, in addition to the additional resources link, there is a link to provide feedback. I'd like to encourage everyone who participated today to fill out the feedback form. It will allow you to give us your impressions of today's seminar, and there's also spots to suggest additional topics for future series of seminars. Okay, so let's move to question and answers. We have several minutes. So let me check with our phone participants and see if anyone has a question for Dr. Walker.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
My name is Suzanne Davis. I'm with the Department of Toxics in California. I'm wondering, how do you see the EU REACH program, the European Union REACH programs, that's going to be implemented this summer, being a possible resource for getting some of that tox data or any type of tox data for the nanoparticles or nanomaterials that are on the market now?
I mean, that may be a possible resource. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the REACH program and how it's been currently applied to nano. But, I mean, clearly there are some developments going on to try and at least leverage you know, some of the European activities to kind of get some information, and a lot of the European, even the academic communities over there are trying to get some information and linking with U.S. partners. But in, you know, if they can require it for materials that are then marketed in the U.S., then that might be a source. But one thing of concern, though, is, you know, the current EU restriction on certain testing in animals, and the plan to move to a non-animal testing kind of paradigm is a lot of has a lot of concerns for a lot of people in Europe, I can tell you, in that it really gets down to how we're going to validate some of the in vitro data and how that then pertains to health effects, because it may be that a lot of the data may actually not be as usable within a U.S. kind of paradigm. I'm not a regular folk, so I, you know, maybe I don't know whether Nora can attest to how they may use some of the EU data for that. But go ahead.
Thank you. We can stay with the phone participants. If you have a question, you can take your phone off mute. Please introduce yourself and your organization. Okay, I have one from an internet participant here. This is from Carla Alker U.S. EPA in Westlake, Iowa, or excuse me, Westlake, Ohio. As a consumer, how can we avoid nanomaterials in products? Specifically, is all titanium dioxide in sunscreens in a nano form?
Well, firstly, I'll take the question in a reverse order. So are all titanium dioxide in sunscreen nano? Well, that would be a no, because some of the, if you go back to the Australian, you think of the Australian surfers and lifeguard, the reason why you have sunscreens that were white was because the metal oxides in the sunscreen were not nano. It's when you get down to the nanoscale that it no longer scatters light, and that's why it's clear. So one thing you can say is if the material says it contains titanium dioxide and it is clear, then it would be in a nanoscale form. One thing to remember, though, with titanium dioxide is the crystal form is extremely important. Most of the titanium dioxide that is in sunscreen is a coated rutile form. The reason for the coating and the rutile is that the rutile form, as opposed to the anatase form, does not produce nearly as much reactive oxygen species as an anatase form. And by coating them, you actually inhibit that even further. So the potential hazard from a rutile form is a lot less than you would expect from an anatase TiO2 that is actually used in for like in remediation applications where you are intentionally using a form that is highly reactive. So it's important to distinguish the types of TiO2 that you would have in a product. The question of how you would want to avoid a nanomaterial, that would come down to consumer labeling on products, and that's where the likes of the CPSC might want to get involved. There are no, as far as I know, any current regulations or requirements for labeling specific materials. And the other thing to consider is, it goes back to the context that I said at the beginning of the talk, there are nano raw materials, and then there are nano products. So there are many nanomaterials that are embedded within consumer products. If you were to think of something like automobile tires, have a lot of carbon black, which is a known nanoscale material. It's engineered because you can produce it, but you can't manipulate it. But it's embedded within a tire. So the type of product and how the material is within that product is very important. So that's some of the considerations when thinking about that.
Great. Let's check back with our phone participants. If you have a question, please introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hello. My name is Ronell Haney. I work in the IT department at Region 5, EPA Region 5 in Chicago. I have a two-part question. The first part is, since this technology seems relatively new, I was looking at the different departments that were supporting this initiative. Have you met or have different religious or spiritual factions been consulted in the research of nanotechnology? And have you met great opposition in this study? And the second part...
I'm not sure I understand the question, actually, if you can try and repeat that.
You don't understand the question?
I didn't understand what you... Have I met opposition?
Yeah, the reason I say this is because with nanotechnology, it seems like it could lead into the realm of cloning, or, like you said, with great power comes great responsibility. Asking, has there been, in your opinion, any... opposition or protest from...
So protesting about the development of the technology. Oh, there's plenty of people protesting about the development of the nanotechnology as a technology, and there have been calls for moratoriums. Researchers I know have voiced concerns that they may be shut down if, you know, nano is painted with a single brush type of thing. So in that respect, there's been opposition from people, and that has actually prompted a lot of the activity, I think, of looking at nanotechnology early on in its development. I don't know if that answers the first part of your question effectively.
That does,
okay,
to a degree. And the second part, do you have a specific application that's already out there or that's in the process of being created that will track each engineered nanoproduct? Because I ask this because it seems like it would be really difficult in terms of, since these materials would be transported, and I'm assuming they would be transported on a varying basis, what kind of tool could you use to keep an accurate account of what's going on?
So you're talking about tracing of materials and where they're transported and...
Tracing, by tracing I mean locationally tracing.
Locationally tracing.
Choosing probably what he means is there any kind of labeling technique that be applied?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In terms of, if you want to look at, is nanofilm titanium dioxide getting out in the environment, how do you measure that? I think, is that the kind of question you're thinking? Or if there were carbon nanotubes in the environment, how would you trace where they were?
Right, and if so, do you have an application out there or a database that's accessible for public use that could show me how this...
That's not under the auspices of the National Toxicology Program, and I'm not sure that would even fall under EPA's mandate to do that. But in terms of tracing, you're talking about environmental analysis, really. How can you look at the exposures in the environment to nanoscale materials? And that's really an area of a lot of research at the moment. There have been some suggestions that one might use specific non-radioactive isotope labeling of metals within a nanomaterial that can make it distinguish it from the natural material that's out there, because then you could actually look for specific signatures that may have come from the nanoscale form, but that's really just been a suggestion in the literature. How to monitor these materials in the environment is actually where the research is, and that's I think one of the areas that that Nora mentioned that is a lot of research is going into. That characterization, it falls into the characterization in biological systems, in wet systems, in environmental media as well. There's no simple solution to that at the moment.
Right, and can I say something? Thanks. Correct. If the compound should prove toxic, then EPA would have to determine where it was in the environment, how it passed in the environment, and we get more into it. But right now, we're trying to understand that. And the other thing I wanted to mention was I forgot that Berkeley actually enacted a law recently about, what was the law for nanomanufacturing facilities, right, Nigel?
Yeah.
I'm trying to find it, and I can't find the...
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. So you might want to look at that. Of course, Berkeley usually does such things ahead of the curve, sort of. They kind of tip the boat, sort of, in that respect. That's all I would say. Sorry.
I mean, the issue there with monitoring is, one can monitor for sizes of particles in general, but so you could actually look for just generic, like the PM, just reduce your PM level down. But it's not going to tell you what the specific nanomaterial is. And even if you, let's take metal oxides as an example. If I wanted to measure metal oxides in the environment and find out which ones were nano, I'm not sure how I would do it at this point. Because I'm doing such studies in vivo, and the only way I can actually look for the metal oxide particles is actually to measure for the titanium. And that doesn't tell me anything about the size of the material.
Right.
So I could be looking at a very large aggregate of material, and if I was looking at a biological sample, an environmental sample, I would just see the titanium levels. It tells me nothing about the size.
Right, that's why that's another area of our interest, monitoring and detection.
So I hope that answered your question.
Thanks. Thanks for jumping in, Dr. Savage, and answering that. And that's a good spot for us to open the questions up for both of our presenters. So if you have any additional questions for either Dr. Savage or Dr. Walker, we can take those now. We'll stay with the phone lines. Please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, we'll go back to the Internet list of questions, and this is from Lucia Nieder, Petrobras, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She thanks Dr. Walker for his presentation and asks if the research with organoclays for pollutant removal, such as from wastewater and contaminated soils, are these materials also being considered as nanotechnology, and is it subjected to any regulation in the U.S.?
I'll answer the first part, and I'll let the second part go to Nora. Yes, I considered them under the within our nanotech safety initiative. It's they're lower down the priority listing for me because of the other issues where there's more potential for direct human exposure. As to whether they are regulated, Nora, you got any clue on that one? I don't believe there are any regulations on the book about nanoscale anything. Other than there's a current intelligence bulletin on titanium dioxide from NIOSH that specifically distinguishes nanoscale titanium dioxide from macroscale titanium dioxide. But that currently from the U.S. government is the only, and it's not even a regulation, it's a proposal. That, to my knowledge, there are no specific regulations currently that pertain to nanoscale versus microscale.
That's correct.
Okay, let's check back with our phone participants again. Please introduce yourself and your organization.
Yeah, this is Ricky Sinha from Brian and Gear. When you study toxicity and exposure for nanomaterials, do you consider only the materials themselves or also the matrix in which they are embedded? For example, the titanium oxide in sunscreen, would you consider that sunscreen the titanium in sunscreen or just the titanium dioxide?
So to use the titanium dioxide as the example, you know, the focus of our study is actually on the titanium dioxide itself. So the way we actually use that is actually in a very generic sunscreen or, you know, which is essentially an all-water emulsion. We aren't testing the sunscreen base itself or an interaction with components of sunscreen at this phase because we have to essentially reduce the sunscreen formulations vary even though they're similarly based, and so we can't test it in every single formulation, so we use a very base level all-water emulsion formulation to look at just the inherent effect of the TiO2 itself.
We can stay with the phone participants. Please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while we're checking with them again, I'll read another one from an Internet participant. This is also from Andrea Candara, New York State Department of Health in Troy, New York. With the potential for having thousands of distinct nano-engineered particles due to manipulation of physical chemical properties, have any nano-engineered particles in particular been identified as higher priority for evaluating toxicity? Also, what strategies are being used to identify which nano-engineered particles should be evaluated for toxicity?
Great question. And it's the question that it's fair to say keeps me awake at night, because, you know, in terms of the priorities, the way I approached, you know, everything that I mentioned there on the NTP's current activities were essentially the priorities that we looked at in terms of nanomaterials. Metal oxides by virtue of their production volume and use in sunscreens, quantum dots by virtue of the fact that they're cadmium-based, and, you know, to look at the issue of essentially a nanocrystal form, a nanomaterial that is based on something that is already hazardous, known to be hazardous. The nanotubes by virtue of their increase in production volume. The fullerenes for their use in as drug delivery vehicles and also in embedded materials. So the first step is you have to use a classification on how you're going to prioritize. on what physical chemical type of classification scheme. And so I broke it down into those classes. And the approach I then am looking at is within those, what chemistry or surface chemistry do I think is the most likely for human exposure? Oftentimes I'm making that decision in the absence of any exposure data. So, and that was one of the impediments to progress that I pointed out at the end. Knowing what to test, in the absence of knowing what all the different surface chemistries are, I will go with the most non-modified form. So the fullerenes, I'm going for pure C60. For the tan dioxide, we're using, because a lot of the rutile forms are coated with a variety of different coatings, we're going for the purest form, which actually is an anatase form. For the single-walled nanotubes, the plan is to look at, very just naked single-walled nanotubes, because you don't necessarily want to have all the different decorations on them. I've taken the tox data, which was a bit more of an in vivo type of a study, to the multitude of permutations. This is where you have to have the strategy of linking the in vitro data on the same well-characterized materials to with benchmark materials that are then studied in the in vivo studies, because you can't do all the permutations in vivo. That's where the use of in vitro approaches will have its power to do more of them, but you have to benchmark that to well-conducted studies of at least one or two materials that are then done in vivo. So it really is the thing that keeps me awake at night, making sure that I'm thinking I'm testing the right thing.
And just to expand upon this, has there been any validation as yet upon any potential in vitro tests that would serve that function?
There has been attempts to validate. There's data is starting to come out in the literature from, Andre Nell's group, from David Warheit, where they're using short-term tox approaches and in vitro cells to look at oxidative stress and inflammatory responses, essentially as surrogates for pulmonary toxicity. And what most of these approaches, what they show is, well, for certain endpoints, there's some correlation, but it's not perfect, and for other tests, there's no correlation. Really, we're only at the beginning of making those validations, and I think it's going to be quite a few years before we have a battery of tests that can actually increase or decrease our confidence in making an assertion of potential hazard. And that's the thing, I don't think, it's probably unrealistic to expect a single test will give you the correlation to potential in vivo hazard for a given endpoint in a given tissue. There's a lot of research to do for that.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll stay with the phone participant. Please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while they're thinking, we'll go ahead and make a few closing comments. We're nearing the end of our allotted 2 hours. I'd like to point out one more time on the seminar homepage through the Clue-In website, you will see a link to additional resources. On that page, we will post the additional items mentioned by Dr. Savage during her talk. There's also a link there to the Risky Learning homepage, which will give you the entire nanotechnology schedule. With that, I'd like to thank Dr. Savage and thank Dr. Walker for fine presentations today. And we'll sign off. If there are no further questions from anyone on the phone lines, we'll sign off.